Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 100 of Registry Matters. Larry, how are you?
I guess I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Okay, you're going to bring out the curmudgeon already, right?
Oh, doing fantastic. Didn't think we would do this for the same number of years I've been alive.
Do you know we actually crossed 2 years on the 22nd of October? That was when the first episode was released.
I didn't know that. And we had, what, 3 listeners on that one?
That may be a stretch, to be honest with you. But before we get going too far, Larry, I have to play something for you.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please help me celebrate the 100th episode of the Registry Matters podcast, brought to you by that tech genius Andy and his co-host Larry, who is king all things curmudgeon and also a confirmed member of the Lincoln administration. Congratulations, guys, on the 100th episode. No one thought it could be done, I'm sure, yet here we are. Congratulations, guys, and here's to another 100 episodes.
But the law doesn't permit you to do this, and we're going to shut you down.
If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
FYP. FYP.
But the law doesn't permit you to do this, and we're going to shut you down.
If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
FYP.
FYP. But the law doesn't permit you to do this, and we're going to shut you down.
FYP.
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 FYP. FYP. FYP. FYP.
But the law doesn't permit you to do this, and we're going to shut you down.
FYP. FYP. If you have a problem with these thoughts,
but the law doesn't permit you to do this, and we're going to shut you down.
What's up, Larry? How are you?
Well, that was kind of, that was Darth Vader, wasn't it?
No, that was our super patron, Mike, in Florida.
Alrighty, that was pretty cool. A lot of repeats, but very, very funny.
There were a lot of repeats. Before we get going any further, I'll play you a couple more. They're just pretty short ones.
Hey guys, I just want to congratulate you on your 100th episode of the podcast, and I encourage you to continue to bring us insightful, well thought out information regarding our legal system and ways we can improve it. I wish you all the best in the future.
Are you ready to dive into the breaking news?
I like that one. Who was that?
It's a friend of mine that lives up the street. His name's Andrew.
Andrew. Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
He is one of my liberal do-gooder friends.
There are no liberal do-gooders in the state of Georgia.
I would almost be inclined to agree with you there. But before, we can dive right into this for the time being. So I guess the breaking news would be that on Tuesday, the Georgia judge, he granted the injunction against the Butts County knuckleheads.
That would be true. The United States District Court in the Middle District of Georgia, Judge Mark Treadwell, I believe. Is it Treadwell or Treadway? Anyway,
Treadwell.
It's a federal Treadwell granted an injunction against the Butts County Sheriff's Office for their poorly designed and misguided attempt to do compel speech for a second year. And we're gonna have a deep dive later. But Ashley, what were your thoughts about that amazing judicial decision?
I love that opinion.
Wasn't it great?
It was great. The judge went above and beyond and did all this research for it, and we'll discuss it later, but it is a wonderful opinion.
Like it. But tell me this, though. Didn't he say that he was going to, I'm going to take it all the way to the Supreme Court, by golly?
He has been quoted as saying that. There's one thing that I always encourage people to do is to really think about the ramifications of what they're doing, because right now his impact is limited to this case in the Middle District. If he appeals it to the 11th Circuit, he's going to broaden the impact because the 11th Circuit is going to agree with us. And if he's nutty enough to take it to the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court continues with its unabashed support for First Amendment rights, he's going to lose there. So he's going to potentially make the same mistake to people that insisted on having the same-sex marriage issue litigated by the Supreme Court. He may just help us set the precedent for the whole country. So think about what you're doing, Sheriff Long.
I like it. Larry, I want to read something to you that I sent to you on June 23rd of 2017. Do you have any ideas what I sent you on June 23rd of 2017?
Sure, I have that right here in my diary.
It reads, "Hi, Larry. Let me first say that I completely realize how much work this is going to be on both parts. The amount of technology going into this is kind of mind-numbing. That is only balanced out by the amount of legal analysis that is necessary to delve into this with any level of authority, along with a professional friendship relationship behind it. Therefore, you and I are uniquely qualified to pull this off. In abstract, my idea is to have a weekly, flexible, podcast where a discussion of 30 to 60 minutes occurs about various subjects related to the registry. This includes news items, SCOTUS, legal challenges, legal terms, legal strategy, advocacy, etc. The list of subjects is whatever we want. The amount of time to have the discussion is also wide open. Who are we and why are we doing this? I only know of one other person doing some kind of level of content like this, but no one else is doing this specific thing. Whereas you are the legal expert, I will play part of the facilitator to ask questions to you, my people, to understand. Since I am by no means a legal person, I will dig information out of your brain to hopefully bring it down to my people to understand. This isn't everything, but it is most of it. I know it's a boatload to digest. My question is to you, are you interested? Warmest, Andy." Do you recall?
It sounds vaguely familiar. And what was my response?
Well, I mean, we are here at episode 100. So after dragging you through the mud, kind of kicking and screaming for a little while, then October 22nd is when we released the first episode. So it took a couple months to get things rolling.
I can't imagine I would have even answered an email like that in an email. I suspect I would have called you. Did I actually answer that?
The answer may have been something like, "Sure, we could give it a shot. And can you answer the question of, do you know what a podcast is? Or did you know what a podcast was?"
I had no idea. That's what I'm saying. I can't even imagine I would have answered that. I would have probably said a what?
Right.
I had heard Rush and different people, Sean Hannity, talk about they'll tune into the podcast, but I had no idea what they were talking about. And I'd heard people say you find it on your favorite podcast app, and I had no idea what they were talking about either. So I would have probably called you and said, "What on earth are you talking about?" is what I would have done.
Yeah, I understand. So to continue with the theme of the evening.
Hey, happy 100th episode of Registry Matters. Happy anniversary, Larry and Andy. Such a great podcast. Always enjoyed it. And I hope to hear many, many more. Happy anniversary, 100th episode of Registry Matters.
Do you know who that was, Larry?
Oh, I think we all know who that is. That's one of our loyal patrons from up in the Northeast Corridor.
Yes, that is Charles from New York, who has made claims that he couldn't live without the podcast. I think he has said something along those lines. Maybe that's too dramatic.
Well, he managed to make it a number of years before we were here.
Yes, that is true also. And let's back up for just a second. We heard a voice a minute ago, and there wasn't any sort of proper introduction. Who was that? Who came on during the breaking news?
Oh, that would be Ashley Raymore Cloud, the New Mexico Liberty and Justice Coalition staff attorney, former prosecutor, and now she's come over to the right side. But she had this delusion that she was doing good work as a prosecutor, and you could do more to administer justice. But I mean, what kind of delusion was that, Ashley, to think that you could actually do justice as a prosecutor?
It was completely delusional. I went with it for 25 years, but at some point I had to wake up, and here I am on this side.
I still want to have like a deep dive with you on that whole detour, maybe a Patreon extra that we could do because I'm baffled by the concept, because all the stuff that we cover here just seems to be prosecutors are not our friends at all, ever, except for people like Larry Krasner.
Well, that's because everybody forgets that prosecutors take an oath to do justice, not just to prosecute people and win cases. And they completely forget that oath the minute there's a news camera or anything else in front of them.
Unbelievable.
Well, what I can say for Ashley is before I ever knew her personally, that we would, the most defense lawyers associations have chat lists that they share help with one another and brief libraries and stuff. And I'd been a member, associate member of our list for a number of years. And occasionally there was gripes about prosecutors and kudos. So there was never any gripes about Ashley. There were kudos from time to time about how reasonable. So I think that in fairness to say that there are prosecutors who take justice seriously and they do look at the case and the evidence and they do decide to do the right thing. But unless they're elected as the prosecutor, they have limited discretion because even those who allow more discretion than others, ultimately, there is a boss in the corner office. Was Lim in a corner office or did he have a middle office?
Lim has multiple offices.
That's the DA where Ashley last worked. But so sometimes prosecutors who want to do the right thing are not allowed to do the right thing. And it's not just them. It's the one who has been elected is the one where you have the biggest beef because they're the leader and they set the tone for how the office operates.
That's very true, Larry. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Richard, just to throw a shout out. Richard gave us a one-time donation there. He was not comfortable with the Patreon platform, but the Richard that's up, he says Havid up there that way. You probably know who I'm referring to.
Yeah, that was so nice of Richard. Thank you, Richard.
Yes, thank you, Richard.
Yep, and let's go into article number one, and this is coming out of NOLA.com. This is a teen beat up a stranger he recognized as a sex offender, now faces hate crime count. When did beating up a sex offender become a hate crime?
It's not here in my state. Is it? What state is this article out of? I didn't catch that when I read
Louisiana.
It.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's Louisiana since it's NOLA.
Yeah, it's in Louisiana.
I'm trying to see which area. It looks like it's right downtown, so it's south of Claiborne Avenue. Claiborne Avenue is right downtown New Orleans. Here we go. Like, you know, we cover this on a pretty regular basis that people either mistakenly find somebody that looks like somebody else. There was a guy that looked like Johnny Depp about a month or two ago in California, and then this guy, teen beat up a stranger. This has to be some sort of like a stepping stone for us to get these cases into court in a larger sense that there's literally a public safety issue for anybody that's on the list that they could just get the shit beat out of them randomly.
It's total vigilante justice here. It's interesting about the hate crime, though, because they're premising it on the fact that he targeted his victim and his victim was a stranger. That's a pretty broad hate crime. A lot of the states just have very narrow tailoring of the definition of hate crime, but I'm curious to see what he actually ends up either pleading to or getting convicted of.
Would you be so kind to expand on what you just said about a broad definition there versus narrowly tailored?
So what they're premising it being a hate crime on is that his victim was a stranger and that he targeted him solely for the fact that he was a registered sex offender. Most hate crime bills are a protected class statute, meaning you're old, you're disabled, your sexual preference, things like that. So this is a pretty broad reading of a hate crime statute, but we'll take it.
Right. And what about what I was just saying a minute ago, that this seems to be an avenue to target things in a larger sense about the public safety? I guess you have to have a victim always. You couldn't just then transfer this to take it to a different state. And, you know, if there isn't a crime, if there isn't a victim, you couldn't even try and bring challenges, could you?
You may or may not be able to. What actually comes to mind is when you publish on the registry, because this is exactly what happened. Somebody gets published on the registry and they're a victim of vigilanteism. A lot of the websites that you see will state that you're not allowed to use this for any other premise except for purely informational, blah, 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 in an effort to state, hey, we're not encouraging vigilanteism. We're trying to keep the people on this website safe. But in fact, they can't. They can't keep them safe because this is exactly what happens. You publish somebody's picture, somebody's going to go after them. And I think Larry will actually deal with that a little bit later when we get to the Halloween site. Halloween lawsuit, because that's essentially one of the arguments that the judge makes too.
Larry?
Well, if I were on this person's defense team, people, you have to think in the mindset of which team we're on. Our criminal justice system doesn't have a kumbaya where we try to work together for the collective good to come up with the best outcome. There's some systems designed that way. That's not the American system. Our system is one of an adversarial approach. And so if I were on the defense side, which is where I've always been, I would give no regard to the fact that he beat up a sex offender. Our job is to defend him and make sure the state does not secure a conviction. So I would just take what Ashley gave me as a gift, and I would run with it and try my best to get the charge dismissed, because I would say that this is an overly broad statute that allows for whimsical and uneven prosecution, and it's not sufficiently tailored so that it informs a person of ordinary intelligence of how to conform their conduct to law. It's already against the law to beat people up. So I would say at most, you've got the simple version of this crime. He's overcharged because hitting him with a hate crime is your hate crime statute so broad that anybody can be charged with a hate crime. And I would try to derail the prosecution, or at least minimize the damage, because that's our job in the defense. And I think Ashley would agree with me on that. If we're on the defense side, our job is to wreck the state's train or to minimize the damage.
No, you're absolutely right.
Well, but people, they have the kumbaya idea that we're supposed to somehow or another come in and tell the prosecutor, yeah, he done it. Yeah, what can we? That is not our job when we're defending people. Our job is to make sure you don't win. So our job is to look for ways to minimize the damage if you do win. And right now, if I were on his defense team, that's what I would be arguing, that this is a regular battery or regular assault, and it doesn't qualify as a hate crime, and that enhancement that he would receive should be dismissed. Now, that's not my personal view, but you have to separate your personal view from your professional view. If you can't do that, I think you should get off the case. What do you think, Ashley? Should you stay on a case where you have a personal bias that you can't do your job effectively?
So you can. I think everybody has personal biases. If it's going to stop you from doing your job effectively, i.e., you hate your client and you truly can't put that aside, then yes, you should get off the case. Most defense attorneys are pretty good about going ahead and defending their client, even if they feel that they're guilty, because they're entitled to a defense. They're entitled to due process. And it's funny that you say that, Larry, about it being overbroad and that would be the defense, because that would be a great defense. And as a prosecutor, essentially, I would put this in front of a jury and state, if this person is willing to do this, how many times will they be wrong and do it again? So they go out, they think somebody raped somebody, they think somebody did something, and they go and they take the law into their own hands. We have laws for a reason. And that's what I would argue as a prosecutor in this case. I'm not sure how they're going to get by the hate crime. I'd have to see the Louisiana statute on the hate crime, but I do think that there's a good argument to be made that we need to protect people that are vulnerable. And I do think sex offenders are vulnerable because they're published and out there.
Well, Nancy, that's a whole separate question. I have every belief. First of all, I would not want anybody to be on a public registry. But if we're having a public registry and we're going to put a bullseye on people's back and on their head, we absolutely should have a horrendous penalty for attacking those people. So I agree that should be the way the law is. But my job is to defend based on not the way the law should be, but the way the law is be. And if the law is be doesn't qualify this as a hate crime, I'm going to do my best to knock you down on that, because that doesn't give you the right you as a prosecutor don't have the right to make the law what you'd like it to be. You have the job to prosecute within the law as it is.
Touche, Larry. Touche.
So anyway, we would be at each other professionally, and we would go out and have a meal afterwards. And I'd say and the way it used to be collegial, I think, actually, I don't know how it's been changing over the years, but when I first started this business, the defense and prosecutors were very collegial. I mean, the argument we just had would be ending at the courthouse steps. And we would go on about life and talk about our kids and whatever else. And whoever won would have no relevance for the rest of the day. Is it still that way, or has it gotten uglier and uglier because of the tone of the discourse that's going on out in the country? Has that changed the working relationship between the prosecution and defense teams?
So at least here in most of the counties, and there are some counties that it's never going to be like that. But for example, in our bigger counties Here, it is like that. We go out to lunch and then we go back into court and we argue and then we discuss it later about, oh, I can't believe that you made that argument. Oh, I can't believe that you said this. And we do it jokingly. And it's, for the most part, it's really collegial, because what people have to remember is, in order for the justice system to work, both sides have to come to the table and do their job, period. Whether it's adversarial, whether it's fight everything. If it is going to be fight everything, nothing's going to get done. So it's better to work on the stuff you can work on and save your battles. And that's pretty much what causes that collegialism. Plus, we jump sides all the time. So it's important that you never really alienate somebody that might be on your team at a later date.
So, well, the adversarial system, I think, is very confusing to a lot of people, because they think that as a defense attorney, you have some obligation to expose the truth. We do not have any obligation whatsoever to expose the truth. And that they said, well, your job is to get at the truth. Our job is not to get at the truth. The truth is irrelevant. Our job is to defend the person who's been accused, that has all the weight of the state or the federal prosecution coming down on them, and to make sure that they meet all the elements of the crime that they've charged, and that they have sufficient evidence to convict a trier of fact beyond a reasonable doubt that our clients did that. Our job is not to say, well, gee, he did it, so how can we work this out? Now, if we can work a solution out that's favorable to our client with the overwhelming evidence, but our job is not to help the state get to the truth.
Exactly. And somehow everybody is entitled to a defense.
And they say, how can you do that? That's exactly what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to say, Mr. Prosecutor, you took our person in custody. You have the $100,000 bond set. You're the one who's bringing this charge. How can you prove it? It's not our job to do anything to expose the truth.
Right. The burden of proof is always going to be on the state. Make the state prove their case. Make them lay out all the elements of the crime. Doesn't matter if your client is guilty or not. All you have to do is ethically defend your client to the best of your abilities. And that, again, means putting your bias aside. So even if your client is a werewolf or some evil creature that does terrible things, it doesn't matter. They are entitled to a defense.
And in fact, a prosecutor has a higher ethical duty than a defense attorney does.
Yes.
And people roll their eyes when I say that. The prosecution has a higher ethical duty. I can't recite the rule verbatim, but they have an ethical standard that's even higher. Now, I'm not saying they all live up to it, but they have a responsibility beyond what we have on this side of the aisle.
That's because a prosecutor is supposed to also defend the constitutional rights of the defendant. They're supposed to represent the community. They're supposed to represent the victims. And they're also supposed to uphold the Constitution. So it's a pretty heavy burden, and one that I wish more. And there are great prosecutors out there, don't get me wrong. But I wish more of them understood what it is that they ethically needed to do.
Let's move on.
Well, let's see. Onions, carrots, mayonnaise, mustard. Oh, I got to get some lettuce. And sodas. Got to get some sodas. And let's see what else. Oh, yeah. Happy 100th episode, FYP. From Ryan.
That was so cool.
Hey, Andy and Larry, congratulations on your 100th episode, FYP.
Hello, good afternoon, Registry Matters. Christian from Minnesota, Minnesota 4. Congratulations on 100. Pretty soon you'll be up to Larry's birth, 125, correct? I'm kidding. Great job. Work. Happy 100. Very proud of you. Hopefully you make it to 2 and 3 and 4 if it keeps going that way. Again, Christian from Minnesota. Have a great afternoon. Great episode tonight. And FYP.
Registry Matters done hit 100 episodes on a podcast today. Congratulations, boys. Keep up the good work. We're going to continue listening. And I hope everybody else does.
I have no idea who that was. Do you know who that was, Larry?
I wouldn't have a guess.
That wasn't somebody with MF in the middle of their initials, was it?
See, that's who I thought it was.
That's who that was. That was MF.
That was MF. Let's bounce on over to the Boston Review article about Halloween and stranger danger. This article's kind of fun because it points out that pretty much the whole thing is just some smoke and mirrors. It's a scam. It's a scare thing. And there's literally nothing to be afraid of, from that there's no there's no razor blades or chemicals laced in the candies. I mean, there have been a case or two of these things, but it's all bogus. And somehow the public, it's like in our conscious, it's in our psyche now. And this this article, actually kind of a longish article, but just blows the whole thing out of the water.
Well, there actually were some razor blades this year, Andy.
Uh-oh.
A guy got arrested for razor blades. I'm going to send you the link. So
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, I've said I've never heard of it, but now, if this is to be believed, there has been a razor blade incident.
Okay, so out of 300 million Americans, 320, 330, whatever it is, and an annual Halloween extravaganza where approximately a third of the population is under 18 and they're going to go look for candy at their friends' houses. We have one incident and we're going to shut down all of Halloween and do all this trunk or treat and like completely controlled. Why can't kids go walk around neighborhoods and go knock on doors and get scared and toilet paper people's houses? Like, I don't know. That's how I grew up. And that doesn't seem that, like, you know, it's just an annual thing. People kind of lose their minds a little bit and then everything goes back to normal.
Let's be realistic, too, because the razor blade thing, I think, happened here last year as well. And there is zero tie to a registered sex offender.
Fair.
It has nothing to do with it. So
that is correct.
I love that this article starts talking about Michael Myers and how we've turned it into that, and the Halloween and the LSD scares from the 70s and 80s, and then the boogeyman and everything else, and Laura Palmer. They have a lot of good references in here. And the reality is, it comes down to exactly what they're stating. There is zero evidence that Halloween has any impact whatsoever on people that are on the registration or even people that are on probation, that it doesn't, there's nothing to link the two. This is something that's been created by the media and used as a scare tactic.
Would you say, Ashley, that it's just the media has been a willing partner, but wouldn't you think it would be law enforcement that created this through the, I mean, the media just simply tagged along, but they created these multi-agency units to go out and they invited the media along. Wouldn't it be more appropriate to blame this on the law enforcement industrial complex, that they've created this fear, just like they've created the fear about runaway crime and how dangerous it is to go outside your house? It's law enforcement, and the media, of course, is a willing partner. But if law enforcement didn't have these Gestapo units running door to door saying we're checking on these dangerous sex offenders, there wouldn't be a story, would there?
So I guess it's one of those things, which came first, the chicken or the egg sort of thing, because so the media does this and then we have the whole perpetuation that there's horrible stuff happening on Halloween and all the sex offender stuff. I think the law enforcement actually either just reacts to it or continues to perpetuate it and just blows it up too. So I'm not sure which came first. I'm not sure which is reacting to which. But it is. It's a bad cycle that they're just feeding off of each other on. So,
great point. Great point. Because for all we know, the media ran the story first, saying that why are the sex offenders allowed to trick or treat? And the phone started ringing at police chief's headquarters and the sheriff's office saying, what do you mean? So truly, I don't know who started it, but I know law enforcement certainly has done more than their share of. If the law enforcement didn't provide the resources, of course, there's a political price that might be paid for that. But if the sheriff of Bernalillo County did not provide all the resources, there would be no one to follow with the camera, would there?
No, there wouldn't. But the other thing is if they don't, and then we go right back to the media stating, oh, and the police are refusing to do something about it, and then they face the political pressure. So I don't know. I don't know who did it first. But
and not to jump the gun on the Georgia thing, the deputy sheriff, I forget her name again, she seemed to be the driving force behind creating that whole thing, because the county decided, or the city, whatever, they decided to stop doing Halloween in the square. And they said, oh my God, now we're going to have kids running around the streets. We got to keep the sex offenders locked down. So that's where they came up with the idea of putting the signs out there, is just because they stopped doing the trunk or treat thing in Jackson Square.
And they've been doing that for about 80 years in the Jackson Square, but go ahead.
Right. But so they decided not to do it for whatever reason that is. Chamber of Commerce said, no, we're not doing it. But then they somehow that made the extension that they then had to go put the signs out. Again, in the court thing, I don't remember if it was the judge or the Georgia attorney, did he bring up saying that, is there any incidents that you can find where there's been some sort of violation on Halloween? And like, no, there's nothing out there. But they still wanted to push this issue forward.
Right, and we'll deep dive into it. But one of the other things that he brought up as a result of that was that there was nothing to show that just because there was going to be an increase in trick-or-treaters because they didn't have that trunk-or-treat thing going on, that it was actually going to increase any incidents that already weren't occurring. So it was really diligent by the judge.
Tell me this, Larry, from the politics side of the equation, articles like this, to what degree of impact do they have in fighting these silly rules and that happen to us?
They have an enormous impact.
Do they really? I thought you were going to say nothing.
That's what I thought he was going to say.
They do have. It's like the if I'm following the question, if I've got what you're getting at, but the elected officials are very sensitive to the community. Contrary to your popular belief that they go do their own thing, they do not go do their own thing. They go do what they perceive the majority of the people that they hear from want. And they can't read minds, but they do read emails. They do hear feedback from constituents. And I remember I had this discussion after we had our meeting, our first meeting in Georgia at the Locust Grove Library. And I said, well, you know, they're representing the will of the people. And that, oh, no, they're not. I said, yes, they actually are. Well, I don't think that. Well, it doesn't matter what you think. They gauge public opinion by what they hear. And public opinion is scared to death of sex offenders.
Right.
They believe all these really awful things. And if a politician dares to go against public opinion, it will be only a sliver that will survive the wrath that will come to them for not being responsive. And the same thing for the victims' advocates. The victims' advocates can come in and they can cry and they can show emotion and they can talk about something, and you don't dare question them and ask them if their memory could be. I mean, they come and tell a story that happened 41 years ago. Now, I'm not saying that something bad didn't happen 41 years ago, but very few of us can remember in graphic detail what happened 41 years ago. I will confess I can't in graphic detail. But they will come in, and some of the stuff they'll say will be just beyond imaginable. But you can't dare call them out on it. Now, you can call out the sex offender lobbyist, but you can't dare call out a victim's advocate. Whatever they say, no matter how they say it, it's to be believed. And anything that they ask for, you're supposed to say, well, yes, that's very reasonable. They shouldn't have a right to an attorney. Oh, well, of course they shouldn't have a right to an attorney. They shouldn't have the right to any person. Oh, of course they shouldn't have any right to anything. You know, you have all the rights because you were victimized. Of course, we don't know whether you're victimized or not. All we know is that you said so. And that's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But the lawmakers are very, very moved by these stories. And the politics is very, very risky as far as most are concerned. There are a few that could survive, but not many who can survive if you're being labeled as someone who's soft on crime and sex offenders in particular.
But definitely an article like this doesn't take down the whole structure. I mean, you know, the Boston Review, I got to think, is a decently circulated publication with enough eyeballs. I'm skeptical that this does much other than, you know, take it down a teeny little notch. But I got to think that most people reading this are like, oh, no, everything happens on Halloween. So I've got to keep my kids safe all the time. And these people are terrible. I'm just kind of skeptical that this article has any sort of impact.
Well, I'm looking at it from the other side of what the way you're looking at it. This article is saying that Halloween Stranger Danger is a myth. The public doesn't believe this article. This is like the statistics that I did in the conference in Atlanta when the guy almost exploded like that movie Scanners that was.
That was probably the last movie you saw, Larry.
So, I'm shocked he came up with that reference.
I know, right? Christopher Walken. I saw that in the theater, Larry, when I was like 2.
So the average person
believes that that's why children weigh 230 pounds by the time they're in the ninth grade, because the community believes in this danger, in this boogeyman. And so the lawmaker looks at it and says, yeah, it's right. But I guess the way to rephrase it is the lawmaker can't dare go tell you can't stand in front of a group of 150 people and say, you people are all screwed up. This is all imaginary and you're nuts. Try doing that when you're in a public office and tell me how that goes over for you. So this article has a tremendous impact on lawmakers in terms of the ones who think it through, they say, yeah, it is crazy. But it doesn't change the reality of their voters.
You know, what's really funny about this, too, on that note, talking about not changing the voters, is that so you see article after article where they cite the extreme danger that sex offenders are, and they cite all these inaccurate statistics. And then you have articles like this that state, no, 97% are either molested by a family member or the stranger danger is a myth. But it's funny, you don't see that getting repeated. You see the other one where it's like, oh, every single person who walks down the street encounters a razor blade on Halloween sort of thing. But you never see the real statistic actually get repeated.
So, well, I'll give you an example. He's no longer in office, and I don't think he ever intends to run it again because he's in his 80s. So we had a representative here named Tom Anderson, and he was Republican, but one of those who was reasonable enough that you could have very, very pleasant conversations with. And he would admit that what the constituents believed was not true. And he, in a conversation, we both were at NCSL together. We were talking about the sex offender stuff. And he says, well, I help you as much as I can. And he did help us as much as he could. He said, I help you as much as I can. He said, but I'll be roasted by my constituents. He said, even though we know this stuff isn't true, that recidivism is not off the charts. He said, we just had the New Mexico study done at that time. He said, we've even got a New Mexico study that says that. He said, but that's not where the people are. And I keep pointing the finger back at the people because it's the people that have the say-so. We live in a representative republic where the people direct the legislators, not the other way around. I mean, they are representing tens of thousands of people. Like here, a senator represents about 50,000 and a state rep represents covers about 40,000 people. And they try to take into account what that 40 to 50,000 people want, and they don't say, well, FYP, FYP to you, FYP. I mean, that's not the way a representative republic works.
Yes.
So anyway, yes, it is a good article, but it's very impactful on them internally, but in terms of translating to better public policy, don't expect it to do that because that's not where the people are.
One last thing just to point out before we move on. All I wanted to point out is that in the article, it does reference another article that talks about sex offender laws being published in the Boston Review as being draconian and unconstitutional. I think it's interesting that Boston seems to be on a wave, or Massachusetts actually, because they've had some good cases come out of there recently on it. So I think that they are trying to do what they can to persuade the public there.
Hey, this is Jeff from Kentucky. Most people will know me as Captain Crazy on Twitter. I just wanted to call in and congratulate both Andy and Larry on 100 episodes of the Registry Matters podcast. Registry Matters is the first podcast I ever listened to and remains to this day my favorite podcast. I had no idea there was anybody out there that pushes back against the oppressive registry. Through Registry Matters, I have made contact with NARSAW, and I am even able to contribute a modest amount every month to the podcast and to NARSAW. The Registry Matters podcast brings hope to the hopeless, and I look forward to it every Saturday. The listeners have come to refer to funny things that Larry says as Larryisms, and my favorite Larryism is when Andy will say something terrible that registrants have to deal with, such as a homeless registrant got 10 years in prison because they didn't have an address to register, and Larry will say, I don't see a problem with it, Andy. Every time I hear that, I laugh really hard, and if I happen to be taking a drink, it ends up on my phone. Thanks again to Larry and Andy, and congrats on 100 episodes. And as always, FYP.
Andy, Larry, this is Justin, Patreon member from Tennessee. I just want to call and congratulate y'all for y'all's 100th episode. This is a great milestone. Y'all have been doing a great job. I have been greatly enjoying the podcast. Y'all have been putting out great information, great insight, and you're really helping us to better understand the laws and situations that we face on a day-to-day basis. So I appreciate y'all's hard work. I appreciate all that you have done for us. And once again, congratulations. And as always, FYP.
New Mexico's Liberty and Justice Coalition wishes to congratulate Registry Matters on its 100th episode. Thank you, fellows, and keep up the good work.
He almost slipped back into his country accent there, I think, at the end.
So, and thank you, Justin. You've been one of our loyal patrons, and thank you for those kind words, everybody. But, yeah, Justin's been nice to us.
And Jeff, before that, Jeff has been a patron probably for about a year as well.
So we appreciate all of our loyal patrons. I was telling John, talked to him before we started recording, and I said, it's mind numbing that people appreciate us as much as the patrons do, because as tight as I am, I can't imagine that I would do the same thing. So it's.
Well, I got my Patreon bill today, Larry, and it was $28. And only $1 of that goes to Registry Matters. I just do that to make sure the system works. So $27, I support other people's content.
So, you're amazing. I don't have any support other than to ours, but you people.
All right. Well, you guys, you people are going to go into this New Mexico something or another that I have no idea what it is. And we will continue with the shenanigans later.
Larry, we have great news, don't we?
We do. We have been gearing up for lawsuits for some time, and we finally put our team in place, and we have launched our first lawsuit. And I'm going to let you carry the most of the lead on it, but I'll tell you that we are not trying to get people off the registry at this stage. The result may be that people may be removed from the registry. But New Mexico law is clear. We do not have an obligation to register here just because you have an obligation in another state. That does not create a registration obligation here. And I've even had some discussions with people very close to me who think that it does. And I say, no, it doesn't. And our law is that you have to have be convicted of an offense that's equivalent. Not even the North Carolina language, where it says substantially similar. Ours is equivalent. And actually, I see a big difference between substantially similar and equivalent in terms of the legal standards. What do you think?
Oh, there's totally a big difference. The difference being that when you say equivalent, it has to match up with what the elements of the statute for that particular offense actually state. So if it says you have to intend to do something, then your out-of-state conviction, you had to have intended to do something. And so, if it requires using a telephone, then you have to have in your particular instance that you used a telephone. So it has to match.
Well, and I'll give an example. I was talking to one of our patrons before the program today, and he solicited a minor in another state. And some states protect all minors that are under the age of 18. Our state believes that if you are entitled to have sex at 16, which is our age of consent, except for when there's authority over the other person, that it stands to reason in order to get to the point of having sex, you would probably have to solicit, unless just someone just grabs you and they think you're so hot that there's no discussion. So in order to get to the stage of having sex, which is lawful, it would stand to reason that there would be some discussion about sex. So therefore, if you solicit a person who is above the age of consent, that is not a registrable offense here, because it is lawful to propose to have sex with someone who's above the age of consent. Well, this person was in a state don't want to give out too much information, but this person is currently residing in a state where they don't have that protection. They cover everybody if they solicit a minor. So if that person were to move to New Mexico, that conviction is not equivalent to anything we have here. Yes, it is a sex offense, but all sex offenses are not registrable. So our argument for this lawsuit is about whether or not the person has an equivalent offense. And that's our beef here, is that we don't have a process in place for that equivalency determination to happen. So Ash is going to tell us more about the case, but that's our beef, and take it away from here. Where are we going with this lawsuit?
So where we're going with this lawsuit is that this is the first step. There is case law that came out in 2012, and then there's been subsequent case law that states that you are entitled to due process when you move here to see if you meet that equivalency test. So you don't just show up in the state and they take a look at it, which is actually what they do, but you're not supposed to. They take a look at it and go, oh, the statute is the same as this statute, so you have to register for 20 years or lifetime every 90 days. What they're doing here is they're doing it that way. The case says that you have to get due process, meaning you're entitled to notice, you're entitled to a hearing, and you're entitled to an appeal if you disagree with their translation. The other thing that's happening here is there are about 1,000 people that are still awaiting translation, meaning when you show up here and you have to go register, they automatically default you to lifetime and every 90 days, or 20 years and every 90 days, or some consideration, oh, you had to register in that state, so you have to register in this state. Or, I mean, they're making these requirements without actually meeting the test, which is, was it an equivalent offense? You get a hearing. The case law suggests that that's in front of a court, which they're not doing. Basically, you show up at the sheriff's department, they make a determination, or they bump it up to the Department of Public Safety. They make a determination, and they basically are just going off a grid or a metric. So our lawsuit is to force them to do what the case law said that they needed to do and what statute said they needed to do, which is give people due process. Don't just bring them in and make them register by default for every 90 days or lifetime. And while you're awaiting that translation, then it should default to the least intrusive one, which would be the 10-year annual. And so that's what we filed the lawsuit on. It's very specific. That's all it's dealing with at this stage. And some of the people that we named as plaintiffs may very well not have to register. Some of them may have to register exactly as the way that they're registering now, and some of them may have a lesser duration and a lesser frequency. So it's across the board.
So you guys are saying that people deserve a break when they come to New Mexico. So if you have to register in Oregon, why shouldn't you have to register here? I mean, that's crazy talk. If you're a sex offender in Indiana and you're a sex offender in Colorado, would that just create a sanctuary, a thing where people could just pour in here by the dozens? Why? What makes people like you tick to do something like this?
So let's be real clear that we're not stating that anybody is entitled to a break. We're not stating that we need to become some sort of haven or anything. What we are stating is that regardless of who you are, if you're entitled to due process, which you are entitled to due process as part of this, you have a constitutional right to get your hearing, to get your notice, to get your appeal, and to get all that stuff done and not just sit on a registry for 10 or more years being published if you don't even have to register in the first place. So it isn't about breaks. It's about a constitutional right to due process. And that's what we're fighting for.
Well, didn't those people give up that right when they committed their sex offense in Oregon? I mean, why did they come here to start with? Why can't they just stay where they be their creeps up there in Oregon? Why did they come into the land of enchantment?
People move here for all kinds of reasons, Larry. Family, employment, the sunshine, the turquoise skies. I mean, there could be a lot of reasons why you move here. And you don't walk away from your constitutional rights when you are charged with an offense, even when you're convicted of an offense. That's why we still have habeases and writs of mandamus and federal lawsuits, because you don't give up all your constitutional rights. And that's what we're proposing.
That's the first stage. That's the answer I was looking for. We have a full faith and credit clause. When you leave one state, if that state has gotten away with doing crappy things, that doesn't mean we should emulate the crappy behavior. Just because Georgia registers people for obscene phone calls, that is to minors, that's not going to force us to register people. We're not going to be driven to enact and carry out misguided policies that you've done in Georgia. You can register as many people as you want to until you bankrupt your state. But we have chosen not to have as broad a registry as you have in Georgia. And we're not going to be forced to have that. Our law is it has to be one of our sex offenses on our list, or it has to be an equivalent from an out-of-state jurisdiction. And until you can change the law, you did put your hand on that Bible. You did swear you were going to uphold the law. And that's what we're going to hold you to. You're going to follow the law, and that it has to be an equivalent. And if you want to try to change the law, you can try to do that. That's your right as well. But until the law says something different, it is an equivalent from another jurisdiction, not just merely the fact you have to register. And we're going to try to hold you to that. That's the whole purpose of this lawsuit.
Right. We have laws in place for a reason. We have case law that came out and stated we have these laws for a reason. So, yes, we are just forcing people to do what they have already been told they should be doing.
And it's not about a break. That's nothing to do with it. When people are registering as sex offenders, that's a regulatory framework. And some states may want to regulate more tightly and regulate more people. We don't. If you look at the population, the analysis of how many per population, there's that grid of the 50 states. We're on the lower end. We don't have as many as Oregon has. We choose not to register as many people here. But that doesn't mean that you get to force, because you're going to register everybody and their brother. That doesn't mean we have to do that here.
Exactly.
Are you people done?
You people.
Mm-hmm. You just wait. I have a surprise on the you people front.
All right.
This is Josh Ho, the host of the Decarceration Nation podcast. Larry, Andy, 100 episodes of Registry Matters is a massive accomplishment. You started out talking about what to many is a really controversial topic, but you did it with such earnestness, intelligence, and compassion that you were still putting out new episodes every week. I really enjoyed being a part of two of these 100 episodes. Congratulations, and keep up the incredible work.
This is Mr. Anonymous calling to congratulate you guys on your 100th episode. My $1 a month is money well spent. Oh, and by the way, FYP.
Andy, Larry, hey, it's Nate from Iowa. I just wanted to give you guys a shout out. 100 is a big deal. I wanted to let you know that if it weren't for you guys, I wouldn't be listening to this podcast. I thought I was all alone out there standing on my pedestal preaching, but I just want to say thanks, guys. And a big FYP.
Hi, congratulations on episode 100. This is Rebecca, and I don't get on Discord as often as I like, but I do like to listen when I get a chance. Just to let you know that I was not a person who knew anything about the registry or the law, never gave it much thought outside of like what I'd read in the news. Y'all have done a great job showing me my own emotional biases, my own ignorance. A great job in helping me see things through a point of view that I had never really considered before. So keep up the good work. I do try to pass along what I have learned. So I hope you know that y'all are making a difference. And FYP.
Do you remember talking to Rebecca, Larry?
I do.
Good. Just wanted to make sure that you knew who that was.
So
shortly thereafter, she became a patron also. She is. She's definitely one of those in a big way.
She's a do-gooder.
She's also a nurse.
So,
did you hear the promo that I had Rick do for us on the podcast, on the live stream the other night?
Yes.
And you, Ashley, have you heard this?
I don't think so.
All right. You might want to mute yourself because you're going to laugh. All right.
I'm muting.
All right.
Registry Matters is more than just a podcast. It gives one the deep insights and analysis of what's going on within the registry. It peels back the layers of what is obvious to expose the hidden traps as well as the tricks of how to create effective change. Each episode is a deep dive into how we, yes, we, can make change. Do you believe that the registry is unconstitutional? If your answer is yes, like mine, then each of us needs to stop waiting for someone else to do it, and we need to step up the plate and take our swing. We can no longer sit by and wait for other people to fight our battles. We need you, all of you, to step up and speak out. But wait, you ask, what do we do? You start by listening to Registry Matters episodes to learn how to become empowered, how to affect change for each of us and our families that are affected by the registry. For more information, visit registrymatters.co or search Registry Matters where you listen to your favorite podcast.
Tell me your honest opinion, Ashley.
I think the only thing that would have made that to a different level would be if he was playing the dueling banjos and Deliverance behind his thing.
I probably could have done that, but I would have ended up getting some sort of takedown notice somewhere along the way. Larry, I hope you appreciate like all the effort that went into this.
I'm sure it was a lot of effort, and I appreciate everybody who took the time to like those all sounded like phone calls. I've learned to tell the difference.
I'm happy that you've been able to figure out the difference. You did hear that the first one was not done over the phone, right?
Yes, but when he suggested we switch from the phone, I said he was crazy, but I can now tell the difference.
I'm very glad. Before we go on to the next article, I think I need to start throwing these out there at you, Larry. So this one is a tribute to you, and actually, since we've been talking about liberal do-gooders.
And this is a darn liberal do-good Democrat.
Bastards.
Thrown out of office talking such craziness. Us liberal do-gooders on the other side of the aisle, we can't make this happen. You know, they'll tell us when we want more money for schools or anything for social-related ills. They say, all you liberal do-gooders, all you think of is more money, and all you want to do is throw more money at the problem. You liberal do-gooders are always out there trying to undermine law enforcement, and then you gripe about what a dangerous society you live in, and then you try to tie our hands so we can't do our jobs. All we're trying to do is provide increase the element of safety. And I think in the case of California, and I'd like for someone to correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the voters in California, through one of their famous referendum processes, I believe that they passed a citizens' referendum to prohibit the Supreme Court of California from interpreting the California Constitution to provide greater protection than the U.S. Constitution, because the California Supreme Court got to be under a bunch of liberal do-gooders. I think the Chief Justice was named Rose Byrd, if I remember right.
That was my liberal do-gooders montage.
I didn't realize I had used that term so much through the 100 episodes.
There was and that's only the ones that I could find that we had done transcriptions for. I started maybe around episode 50 or so on someone just said StarCraft in chat, so I start saying StarCraft. doing the transcriptions. So there could be other ones out there.
Well, I throw that around because I genuinely believe that more of our audience leans towards conservative political ideology. And I do that because that's typically the things that a conservative would say. And I want you to understand that I do very much consider both sides of the argument. I consider if you don't listen to other people, why they believe what they believe, it's just crazy for you to think you know it all. So I do try to understand where people are coming from and what they say that liberal do-gooder is thrown around a lot. And when they don't really have a really deep explanation for not liking something, then that's a way it's a dismissive way to get rid of your point of view, is to say, well, he's just a liberal do-gooder. She's just a liberal do-gooder. Yeah, and it's a very dismissive thing. So when I say that, I'm repeating what I've heard from people who are just very dismissive. If you have a more progressive point of view, that somehow or another that you're mentally deranged and you're just not worthy of having. So
I don't know that those are mutually exclusive though, Larry. You don't have to be one to be the other one.
But you know, the people who have their conservative views, that doesn't magically make them just because they're conservative. There's some very brilliant people that are conservative. Some of what they believe in is misguided, but they believe it fervently. They believe, people who believe, there's still this very day, even no matter how many times we've cut taxes and the budget deficit's gone through the stratosphere, they continue to believe if you cut taxes that somehow revenues go through the roof and you have a balanced budget. They believe that, and I don't know why, but they do. And so therefore, you have to get into a deeper dive with them and say, well, let's just look at the numbers. And if you can get them to look at the numbers, then you can have a rational discussion. But they've heard that all their life, and they just believe it because they've heard it.
Ashley, you probably don't know this, but when we go through these little iterations of talking politics, we are purposely trying to drive our numbers down to zero.
I don't think we're trying to do that. I was trying to give a real example of the point I'm making is that people, for whatever the reasons, they believe without evidence, and then they get mad that law enforcement is able to get people to believe things that don't have evidence. Well, you need to also look in the mirror and see what you believe that doesn't have evidence. If you're capable of being susceptible to believing things that the evidence just doesn't support, why would you be so frustrated that others can believe things that the evidence doesn't support? You're just like them. So we all have to be conscious of believing things, and that's why I have the bumper stickers, "Don't believe everything you think."
I agree with you wholeheartedly. But how do we get, I mean, you know, we're talking about left-right politics at the moment, but this extends immediately over into the registry issue of how do we get all of those people to stop thinking that the registry actually keeps them safe, does any sort of positive anything, maybe just have it law enforcement only. Maybe that would be the most effective kind of compromise. But, you know, they still believe the way that Halloween article described it, that people think that there's going to be some person standing behind a bush snatching your kid as soon as you turn your back on them.
And Andy, I don't know the answer to that. I think people would have to want to spend more time doing deep analysis of things. And that would require maybe giving up some things that are more enjoyable. Being informed requires a lot of work.
So not only does it require a lot of work, but it involves asking uncomfortable questions of people. And I'm going to give you an example that if people asked more questions, they might have different opinions. So sitting in Atlanta one day, and there's a ridiculous amount of registrants in the city of Atlanta. I don't even want to quote what the number is because it's super, super high. And I'm talking to the police officers there and I'm asking them about the whole registration and asking them, okay, so when a child goes missing in that critical 48 hours, you can, under your system, zone in on, okay, a little boy went missing. Let's look at sex offenders that are involved with little boy abductions. And they're like, nope. And I said, okay, so you can narrow it down to at least the scope of the vicinity. Like, this happened within a 6-mile radius. This child went missing, and you can narrow it down by the offenders in there. Nope. I said, so what exactly is it that you can do? And they said, oh, we start calling in. And I want to say the number was like 17,000. It was a ridiculous number. We start calling them in one by one. I said, in 48 hours, you do that? They said, yeah, there's no way for us to do it. I'm like, mm-hmm. But if people started understanding a lot of that stuff behind it and started asking those questions of the lawmakers in their area and everything else, the education might be illuminating for them.
But when the news media publishes all these things that just riles everybody up and confirms their bias already, you know, we can't make any inroads with any sort of critical thinking, logical thinking, anything of that sort, because they're just in their thought bubble.
I like the term thought bubble. It's more of a persuaded by emotion. They're ruling totally based on emotion.
Yes. So, Larry, when you figure that out, you'll certainly get paid the big bucks.
I'll have it figured out by next episode.
Very good. Let us move on. I have a bunch of these to play, Larry, so you're just going to be patient and let me play them.
Hey, Andy and Larry. Congratulations on your 100th episode. Love your podcast. Keep up the great work. And FYP.
That sounded like me.
Hey, long-time listener, and congratulations on 100 episodes, and FYP.
Well, good evening, Andy and Larry. This is Will sending out a huge congratulations upon the 100th broadcast of Registry Matters. And Larry, I want to thank you for your guiding wisdom. It's really a huge advantage having someone that dates all the way back to Abe Lincoln guiding our way. And I have to say it just like you do. We do not support the registry, and things are not how they should be. They're how they is be. And when they put their hand on that Bible and they take that oath, they're going to serve and protect. And that's by George, by golly, that's what they're going to do. But congratulations and have a great one.
Oh, that's cute.
That he did a perfect imitation of Larry and the put your hand on the Bible.
I agree with you. Larry, give us one of those hand on your Bibles.
I put my hand on that Bible. And I swore I was going to do my duty and I'm going to protect my community. And that's what I'm going to do, by golly. And if I have to take it to the Supreme Court, that's where we'll be.
And just for reference on that one, he's got, 3,000 posts on his Facebook page saying that we support you, Sheriff Long, all the way. Unbelievable. And how much, just out of curiosity, real quick, how much would it cost to bring a case to the Supreme Court to defend that? 100? 200?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars just in legal fees alone.
And speculating, Larry, how much do you think the budget of Butts County would be?
Well, as I learned, the Butts County, I was looking at what his fuel source would be, because fuel is an essential element for anybody who's thinking about going to the Supreme Court. And under the Georgia Constitution, the sheriff has the authority to spend any amount of money they want to. And they just simply present.
He literally has an unlimited budget.
He has an unlimited budget. Now, it's limited to what? I mean, if he were to spend so much money that the mill levy had to go up so much, because that's how it would be resolved, if it was really a budget buster, on the next fiscal year cycle, the commissioners would have to increase the mill levy that the county pulls out of their property taxes. Counties typically have property taxes, and then in Georgia, they also have local options taxes where they can levy an additional sales tax that goes to local governments. But those primary revenue sources, the county would have to increase one of those if he were. I don't think spending $150,000, $200,000 is going to cause a mill levy increase, but he, under the Georgia Constitution, he can spend whatever he wants to, and the public is going to support him on this because, as you can mention by the Facebook postings, that he, of those 3,000, are any of them critical of him?
I don't believe so. I mean, I only looked at a handful, but they were all certainly like, thanks for keeping us safe, Sheriff.
So he's going to have wide public support. So even if they had to reallocate some funds from another agency, I suspect that unless it was something very critical, that the public's going to be supporting of him. So he's going to be able to outfund us any at every turn. He's going to have more resources than we do.
Okay.
See,
I thought it was going to be contained inside of the county, and that would then cut into some other budget that they would have later down the line.
Well, it kind of does. I mean, even if he's got the unlimited ability, he's still okay. So he can spend these funds, but that may mean they don't get new squad cars. That may mean that they don't get new ammo. That may mean that they can't do a lot of the things that they intend to do. So he will have to take it from somewhere. And like Larry said, if it requires an increase in mill levy, most people will not vote for an increase on a mill levy or anything like that, even if it's to fund schools. So they don't want their taxes going up. That's the way they read that, even if that isn't the case. So I think it can be contained. I think it's a matter of figuring out whether he thinks he's unlimited or not.
Okay. Should we move on to this crazy article from Wisconsin Public Radio? Lawmakers consider a pay bump for Wisconsin public defenders. This is complete heresy. They should be doing this work based on just their generosity to society.
Well, I think I'd take it a step further. Why should people... They know that they did what they were accused of doing, and why do they even need a lawyer? They ought to come into court, and they ought to take their medicine, and they ought to say, Your Honor, I'm sorry I done this. I'm guilty. That's what they should do. Don't you think, Ashley?
So I actually take it one step further. I think we're going to just dispense with justice altogether, that we just cut the budgets of all the judges, we take away their salaries, and we take away all the prosecutor's salaries, and we take away the police. Because, I mean, if they did it, just send them into court. We don't need a justice system.
We don't need a court. Well, we could just bounce right over to the next article where the cops are also the judges. Or, I'm sorry, they're the prosecutors. So we could just end this all on the street, and we'll have Judge Dredd, and they could try you and then execute you right there on the street. Problem solved completely.
Exactly.
So, be damned, due process and the Constitution.
I know. I don't know why we even bothered with the Constitution. I don't know why it's upheld for all these years. But
stupidness.
I know.
Seriously, let's move into the seriousness of this. That they're going to, looks like they're going to increase the budget by $4 million over the next 2 years, I guess, is how they're wording this.
So it's funny that here in New Mexico, they attempted to do this a couple of years ago, and somebody that I know that's actually a really close friend of mine who is a contract public defender led the charge against it because she was afraid it was going to bankrupt the state, which I'm sure was to the chagrin of all the other contract public defenders, because I too am a contract public defender on the side, and we don't get paid anything. We do this basically because we believe in justice. So the fact that we have to eat and the fact that we have to pay bills and stuff, just
eating
is, I know, so overrated, but
couldn't that then be worked in a different angle, and the prosecutors could go, well, we could prosecute fewer cases so that we don't have to hire as many public defenders at the higher rate. I guess that's that, like, oh, nice. I'm getting patted on the head now, aren't I? Oh, sweet little Andy. He doesn't know anything, does he?
Yes, that was a you're so pretty pot. Yes. So, no.
Larry, bail me out.
Oh, I like that laugh. That's pretty cool.
Was it sick? That's the question. Was it sick?
It was sick. But see, that's what we, on this podcast, I have relentlessly said that of the tripod of the judicial system, on our part of the tripod, we have no control. There's only the primary controller of the heavy docket that is so heavy that we can't even, that's the prosecution. They can control the docket. The judge can control the docket to some degree by holding prosecutors accountable to timelines and granting motions to suppress, which will actually extinguish cases. So the judges can make their caseloads lighter. There's only one tool that a defense attorney has to make their, since they don't create the input. There's only one tool that a defense attorney has to reduce their caseload. So all the people that moan and wring their hands about their caseload being so heavy, they have power to make their caseloads lighter. Why don't they utilize that power? You were a prosecutor for 25 years. When you guys moaned and groaned and whined about your caseload, why didn't you bring fewer cases?
You people. So essentially, it's not about, you're not to consider this budgetary aspect of it. You're not to consider what is bogging down the court system. That's not a consideration. Again, it's right back to let's do justice. Bring the cases that need to be brought and don't bring the ones that don't need to be brought. It seems real simple to me.
Okay, but why did you bring so many cases? Not you personally, but why does the prosecution, why is it that we have conversations on this podcast about something we roll our eyes and say, they actually brought a case for that? If you're so overworked and you're at the breaking point, why do you bring a case where the victim doesn't want to participate and where you have an incredible, just such ridiculously weak cases? Why do you bring those cases if you're so crushed under the caseload? Why do you bring those? And there is an answer I'm looking for, but why do you bring cases like that?
I don't know if it's the answer you're looking for, but a lot of it goes right back to what you were talking about earlier, politics.
That's exactly the answer I was looking for.
That's exactly the corner office making those decisions.
That's exactly the answer I was looking for, because some people listen to this thinks that the prosecutor gets to pick their cases. And I suspect every day when you walked in or on a regular basis, you were handed new files. Only the vertically organized offices were, and there are very few of them. When I say vertically organized, I mean that the prosecutor is in from the ground floor, from indictment, from the initiation of the case, all the way to conclusion and sentencing. Most offices are horizontally organized, and I don't know how yours was organized, but it was vertical. Okay, so you were one of those who did have some say-so in cases that you decided to indict. Mm-hmm. Because like in Bernalillo County, once they've been indicted, that prosecutor never sees that case again. They're doing grand jury all day. And they're not actually following it to its conclusion.
Right. Bernalillo is actually moving to a vertical. There is somebody that does the grand jury for him, but they take the cases to preliminary hearing and they are in from the get-go, versus the way that it used to be, which was completely horizontal. But yes, you're absolutely right. And if more offices were vertical, if they got involved, for example, on homicide cases, I would be involved from the second the officers called out and said, hey, we have a dead body here. So we were on scene with him. When you work a case from beginning to end, you know all your strengths and weaknesses, and it narrows down the number of cases that you bring.
Well, I'm a big believer in that. So then in a vertical organization, then you have only the politics of the elected prosecutor. When the DA says, well, take this to grand jury anyway, even though you don't think that it's a case, even though you know you can indict the ham sandwich, you don't think it's a case that should be indicted. What's the answer to that when the person in the corner office says indict this case? What's the prosecutor supposed to do? Say, no, sir, no, ma'am?
So my response to it, it's funny because I just had a friend reach out to me asking for help on a case that I know for a fact that I ran into the exact situation. And what I said is, I'm not going to do it, but I'm sure you can find somebody else in the office to do it. And they did.
They also say that they're going to add 60 prosecutors across the state. Can one of you possibly, like, is that a significant bump?
Oh, God, that is a significant bump.
That's huge.
That's millions and millions of dollars.
And obviously that many more cases coming down the pike. So they could increase it by 60 and then not increase the public defender. Well, I mean, it doesn't say that they're increasing public defenders. They're just increasing the pay.
So it may not be. I don't know if Wisconsin is one of those states. For example, in the state of Georgia, there are certain, I don't know if it's across the entire state of Georgia, but like their contract public defenders are required. If they're a member of the state bar and they are a defense attorney, they are required to do public defender duty in some of the counties. I don't know if Wisconsin is one of those states. New Mexico is not. New Mexico, we have to put in for it. We get a contract for it. But essentially, it may not be that there are more cases coming down the pike. It may be that each prosecutor is carrying a huge, huge volume of cases. And so they're just asking for more prosecutors to divvy up the load.
And then by like a trickle down kind of thing, that would then create a larger demand for attorneys. So then maybe then more attorneys would step up and they would start getting cycled through if they're part of that plan that you just described, that they would then be cycling through the public defender space. It would just correct itself on its own kind of sort of.
Eventually it would. The other thing that people don't think about it, though, is that then you need more judges too, because they have to start hearing the number of cases. If you actually have the defense and the prosecution, and you have enough of them ready to go to trial, you need more judges as well. It's a trickle-down effect. Absolutely, Andy.
And you would need more judges, like you said, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to point out that this is under the new governor after Scott Walker got... was he term limited, Larry?
No, he lost.
He just flat out lost. All right.
He lost.
And they completely hand-tied the new governor from being able to do things, too.
Well, that's a trend of around the country. They did that in North Carolina. There's something about when some of these states, like particularly in the South, that wasn't so much in Wisconsin, but they did have a majority. Republicans had the majority. When they see that they're losing control of the executive branch and their final acts of office, and they did it in North Carolina, they passed legislation to limit the power of the incoming governor. And they call it a realignment they say we're rebalancing and we're realigning the powers. It's let me call it what it is. It's actually sore loser and trying to hang on to power as much as you can. But that's what they've been doing, is they've been taking powers away from incoming governors. And of course, those are the people who claim that they believe so much in due process and how dedicated they are to the rule of law. And when they have the votes and they have the executive a lot of them would be lame ducks themselves, because some of them maybe did not get reelected. But they come into these post-election sessions of the legislature and they strip the powers of the incoming governor and they think that's somehow good. But back to this article, the hourly pay in Wisconsin, for those who haven't been on the podcast since we talked about Wisconsin, they had been the lowest in the country at $40 an hour. And this is supposedly, it doesn't say how much, but it's going to be a bump for private attorneys who take on the public defender cases. So maybe they're going to get up to maybe $60 an hour.
I was thinking 41.
So it's kind of amazing that $40 an hour, as poor as we are, and I tell people our per capita income is really low, but we're not at $40 an hour. So now we have some really low flat fee on our flat fee scale for the public defender cases. Those have not been adjusted nearly enough. But on hourly billing, I don't think we're anywhere near 40, are we, Ashley?
No.
So we're better off of that.
Very good. I'm going to play the last little batch of these, but then I have some bonus material for us, Larry.
Okay.
Hey, this is Jen. Happy 100 episodes. I just want to thank you guys for giving us a voice, a community, support, and the resources to keep our families and ourselves safer. Also, I want to thank you both for the hope that you provide us, because you're giving us the knowledge to learn how to push for change ourselves. Happy 100, and of course, FYP. Bye.
Hi, Andy and Larry, longtime patron supporter. We're all in Pennsylvania. Just happy 100th episode. You guys do a great job. I look forward to it every week. And, of course, to the schools that believe in this system and so forth, and anybody else, FYP.
Hey, Registry Matters. This is Guy Hamilton Smith. Congrats on the 100th episode, and keep up the good work.
All right, we can go on to the final article before we do the Georgia deep dive, which I kind of teased it a minute ago, is the Appeal Podcast, When Police Officers Double as Prosecutors. I never would have considered this to be a thing, because Larry, you just mentioned about the tripod, and this seems to be a very big conflict of interest, that the person that is going to arrest you and book you, whatever, would be the one that would then prosecute you. This doesn't seem right to me. Not right
at all. I'm going to let Ashley drive the bus on this, being that she's been in that arena.
This is very, very common. I'm surprised that there's only 9 states that do it. But what they're talking about are doubling as a prosecutor for misdemeanor charges. In the state of New Mexico, we have metro courts, magistrate courts, and then we have district courts and on up the appeals court, everything else. But for your magistrate and metro courts, they essentially prosecute DWIs, traffic tickets, resisting arrest, everything up to a full misdemeanor. The district courts are reserved for your felony charges. For the misdemeanor charges, except for DWIs and a couple of the other offenses like domestic violence, officers prosecute in a bunch of the cases. And in magistrate cases, they do anything that does not require a jury trial. If there's going to be a jury trial and it's a full misdemeanor, then the prosecutor is asked to enter. But like, for example, on restraining orders, officers actually are still prosecutors on them, even though you're entitled to a jury trial on them. So this is not a foreign concept. And essentially what it does is allows the officer to come in and make a plea deal with the person, allows them to dismiss it. It just cuts out a layer of it, and it's for your lesser charges. One more thing on that. Is interesting because it says here, meaning thousands potentially face life-altering criminal records without a public defender. Even if the officer is a prosecutor here, you're still entitled to defense counsel. Anytime you are facing a jeopardy of liberty, the Constitution states that you are entitled to counsel.
Do you feel that this is as big a conflict of interest as I think it is?
No.
Okay.
You tell me why you think it's a conflict of interest. I don't think it's a conflict of interest because it's if you've ever had a traffic ticket and you go to traffic court, the officer is also acting as a prosecutor, if you think about it, because they get up there and they testify and they're telling the judge exactly what happened. Most of the time you're there going, no, I didn't, no, I wasn't speeding or anything else. That's all this is. If there's going to be anything different, like a jury trial or anything else, then a prosecutor gets involved.
I mean, I guess like, you know, watching a show like Judge Wapner or whatever, the people are just standing there at a podium and they're going back and forth with the judge. And so they're prosecuting and defending themselves respectively. And then the judge makes the decision at the end, I guess. Is that what this is?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. It's informal like that. The officer is standing there. They submit their citations and the judge either believes them or doesn't believe them. And same thing. It's exactly like Judge Wapner.
All right, Larry, shoot it all down. Tell me where this is all wrong.
Well, it's hard to shoot it down because until just a few years ago, and I can't tell you the year, in addition to police officers prosecuting complaints, we had private complaints. And those, Ashley's been around long enough to remember when a private party could bring a criminal charge. Mm-hmm. You remember those days, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I remember those days well.
You got some horrible complaints that people brought. But again, since it's an adversarial system, a police officer if you had an attorney, the police officer is a witness. And what Andy's getting at, I think, is the police officer is also the witness, and he or she is the attorney. And it's kind of like the person who defends themselves. You kind of have a problem cross-examining yourself. But the police officer is a professional witness. They do this all day long.
Yes.
And they know the they know how most police officers that have been doing DWIs, they know to lay the foundation for the breath card before they move for admission. And sometimes rookie prosecutors don't know that. And the officer will look, the officer will say, you want me to read the score? Well, yes, read the score, for God's sakes. That's what I ask you. And what happens when you read that score when the foundation hasn't been laid, Ashley?
It's a mistrial.
So you've got a police officer who's acting as the prosecution team, and the police officer is also a witness. I don't see it as a big a problem. I mean, other than the fact that the police officer is much better prepared as an attorney than you are. So if you don't have representation, you're in essentially the same posture you would be in if the prosecutor was on, because the police officer is going to be a far better prosecutor than you're going to be if you don't have any legal training.
And I do see that as being the bigger issue. If they are actually forcing people to proceed without a public defender or a defense attorney, aside from, again, a traffic ticket or something really minor, a dog barking citation. But it's any time you are in danger, if there is any type of incarceration that's a possibility, you are entitled to a lawyer. So I would see that as being the bigger issue than the conflict of interest. And I totally get what you're saying, Andy, but that's why I don't think it's as much of a conflict of interest as long as you have a lawyer who can counter that professionalism in that officer.
I mean, that's fair too.
I think the test is 90 or more days, not more than 90 days before. I don't think, like on a petty misdemeanor where it's 90 days or less, are you entitled to a lawyer for a petty misdemeanor?
So even if it's 90 days or less, for example, like on driving on a suspended license, if there is, you are in danger of going to jail, you are entitled to a lawyer.
So if for any period of incarceration, they're entitled to
any period of incarceration is what it comes down to.
So if a judge, theoretically, if I'm sitting on the bench and my magistrate judge, and our magistrate judge is, just for those who don't listen, who don't, of course, they're listening. For those who don't understand, a judge in New Mexico, to be a magistrate judge, does not have to be an attorney. It could be.
And most of them are not.
And some of them are very fine judges that are not attorneys. So I'm not knocking that. And some are not very good as judges. But a magistrate judge sitting here is without a law degree sometimes gets very confused in terms of what due process is required of them, and they haven't, there's a magistrate's a training that they go through, but it's very limited. It's a matter of days or a week or something, isn't it? It's not very significant.
No, and they go to an annual conference, but still, it's. A lot of it is up to, on the other cases, for the prosecutors and the defense attorneys to actually educate that judge.
Okay, but if I'm a magistrate judge and I say, well, you're entitled to an attorney if jail were going to be a sanction, I will proclaim from the bench before we undertake this trial that jail is not on the table. Have I gutted that person's right to an attorney if I take incarceration out of the equation as a sentence?
No.
I have not.
No. Even okay. If you say, which a judge is not supposed to say, I'm not going to send you to jail, therefore you're not entitled to an attorney, that's not the standard. The standard is, the statute potentially call for incarceration?
So mm-hmm. I can't take that off the table as an option. Okay.
Nope.
Are we ready to move on?
We are.
All right. Before we get to the Georgia thing, I have to play this for you, Larry, and try to contain your excitement, okay?
All right. It's like, why don't you people do that? I mean, you claim you're an organization that cares about the offender. Why don't you people tell us where we can live? For God's sakes, what the hell's wrong with you people up there? But again, have you people forgotten what you did when you were 14? I don't understand him. He's paid his debt to society. He was a juvenile. When are you people going to stop? Like in the California prisons when they got grossly overcrowded, the federal judge says, well, I can't make you people build prisons. That's your prerogative. But what I can do is tell you that there's a limit to how many people you can put in these. And you people tried to commit me already. You people failed. And now you're at it again. He doesn't get to say that, right?
It says a little something about who we are in this country. particularly you people in Naperville, are you going to do anything about this?
You people up there in Merlin are really strange people.
Merlin. Don't blame it on all of us.
Goes off and commits suicide. As I said at the time we talked about this, you people ought to be ashamed of yourself.
And they said, what are you talking about? I said, I need to get a driver's license, for crying out. You people do give licenses up here, don't you? Oh, yeah, you go to the Secretary of State.
Well, there you go, Larry. There's my you people montage.
That was when I was in Michigan. I was trying to figure out where to get a driver's license. And in Michigan, they don't have a motor vehicle division. They don't have a division of motor vehicles. And I said, well, I've got an out-of-state license going to expire. I said, how do I get a driver's license? And they said, oh, it's Secretary of State. I said, to what? They said, you go to the Secretary of State. I said, no, I don't need to register to vote. I need a driver's license. They said, yeah, Secretary of State. And I said, it's okay, if that's what you say. So then I asked another person, and everybody was telling me the Secretary of State. What are you going to believe it? You go to the Secretary of State. So that's who does driver's license in Michigan. It's the Secretary of State.
And since you just said the do what, I have to – I wasn't going to play this one. This was like bonus, but now I got to play it. It feels to me like in many of these states, they are aggressive about this stuff because they have an enlarged medulla oblongata.
A what?
It's an area of the brain, like alligators, they're aggressive because they have an enlarged, like the center of their brain. It's just like, but there are certain people that are just aggressive because maybe they have just, like, maybe their brain is wired wrong.
I never knew what that word was. So you learned me something.
It's a little peanut. It's the little walnut size, like center of your brain. It's the fight or flight section of your brain.
All right.
There you go. You did the a what?
Now, what is that one more time so we can get it straight?
Medulla oblongata.
Medulla oblong?
Yeah.
Oblongata.
Yep. It is the little fight or flight part of your brain. And
if you say so.
What you have to do is there's this movie called The Water Boy. It has Kathy Bates, incredible actress, and Adam Sandler, and it takes place in New Orleans, Louisiana, like out in the bayou somewhere. It's incredibly funny, but there's this whole thing about the reason why alligators are ornery is because they have an enlarged medulla oblongata. And he's like, anyway, it goes on, but it's funny. It's very funny. That's where it came from. Someone in chat that night had said, I bet you can't get this into the podcast. And I said, bullshit. I will get this in the podcast.
I take that challenge and raise you too.
Yes. And now there's somebody in chat named Brian in Louisiana. What's the odds of that? All right. Let's cover this Georgia deep dive. We are already at an hour and a half. And so you have 5 minutes. Go. All right.
Well, this is Ashley's, but I'll tell people that as we said in the news teaser, that we have a great victory in the state of Georgia. And I'm going to set up the why is it important, and then Ashley can do the legal analysis. But it's important because we operate under a rule of law in this country, and we don't agree with all laws. But in Georgia, we do agree that there was no law for the sheriff to unilaterally impose a requirement that people post these signs. And we felt that we have to draw the line somewhere. We don't like the states where they have laws, and there are a number of them, and some local communities have laws. But we had a unilateral action by two sheriffs last year in adjoining counties in Spalding and Butts. And we felt strongly enough that we put them on warning right before Halloween last year that they shouldn't be doing this because they lack the authority. And this being we being NARSL, the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws. We put them on warning that you can't do that because you lack any underlying authority. And they laughed and they scoffed and they said, well, good luck. You know, good luck, because no Georgia judge is going to stop us. And a year passed and we were putting together a lawsuit and reaching out, trying to find the right attorneys and trying to find the right plaintiffs. And we filed a lawsuit this year. And we filed in both Spalding and Butts. We didn't file in the counties, but we filed suits against both Spalding and Butts. And even though they're adjoining, they're in separate judicial districts. Spalding falls in the Northern District, and Butts falls in the Middle District of Georgia. So we got assigned to two federal judges. Well, Spalding, congratulations to you. You did the wise thing. You actually folded and decided that they weren't going to post the signs. Now, I don't know if it was because they were wise enough to know they were going to lose the case. I think it was probably because they were trying to escape judicial review. And they figured that, that they could convince the judge that there was no crisis or controversy by saying we're not going to do it in 2019. Well, after discussion with our lawyers, I said, well, no, we still have a very much a live controversy because they said they're not doing it in 2019. They didn't say they're never going to do it again. And the only way we would be willing to withdraw the litigation would be if we can enter into a consent agreement enforceable by the court that says that they won't do it again, period. So Spalding, the issue abated because there was no emergency need for an injunction. So that case is still alive and it'll be litigated another day. But the Butts County Sheriff said, he said FYP, and I'm going to do this regardless. So then we had to have the injunction hearing, which was held a little over a week ago. And the judge ruled Tuesday, and we had a judge who did an enormous amount of work, which Ash is going to expand on. But we've got this beautiful opinion, and the judge enjoined the Butts County Sheriff from enforcing on our plaintiffs. Now, the judge did not grant class certification. The ruling technically did not apply to everyone in Butts County, but the judge did caution that you probably ought not do it to the others. And so at this point, Narsil has won the lawsuit. It's unlikely, in my opinion, that he'll be able to reverse this, but he's vowed to try. We'll just have to let it play out. So, Ashley, what's the goodies that's buried in this case that's going to help? Because the people in Georgia are happy because the other 157 county sheriffs are probably not going to be dumb enough to do this, but. What good is this decision? Why is it important? Why did we focus so much of our energy on this thing when we should be bringing down the whole registry? Why are you people fixated on just one day of the year?
You people.
You people. So there are so many golden nuggets in this opinion. As I alluded to earlier, Judge Treadwell went above and beyond and did independent research related to the case and came up with a lot of good statements that actually don't just apply to this sign issue. We're going to be able to use them in other cases where they're trying to bring broad sweeping impositions on registrants. So let's start with the first thing. As part of the order, he points out that the people that are being forced to put these signs in their yards are, by all accounts, in his own words, by all accounts are rehabilitated. They live productive, law-abiding lives. They're parents, they have children, and there is not, under its system for classifying, has not determined that any of these people pose an increased risk of, again, committing a sexual offense. So then we move on from there. Again, he says, this decision was not based on any determination that the plaintiffs are dangerous. And he goes on to state that later in the case, too, stating that even if they're trying to say that they're saving the public and saving the children and everything else, they have not shown that that is actually, A, what they're doing, and B, that it has any effect whatsoever. In fact, what we discussed earlier is that the sheriff himself acknowledges that he hasn't had any problem with registrants in the county for as long as he can remember, if ever. He can never recall a time when he actually had any issues. Just because they didn't do the trunk or treat this time, and there's going to be an increase in trick-or-treaters, which is what they tried to use as a basis for putting these signs out there, doesn't mean that there is any correlation whatsoever. And the judge comes out and says, the answer is not whether his plan is wise or moral or whether it makes penological sense. It's whether it runs afoul of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. And he says it does. So then he goes on into this brilliant analysis, which essentially sets up in order to grant. And what we have to remember at this stage is that this was asking for an emergency injunction, meaning don't put these signs up before Halloween. In order to meet that threshold, there are four things that you have to prove. And the biggest one being, let me pull it up here, the biggest one being that you can prevail on the merits. And most of the opinion goes to this, do you have a substantial likelihood of success on the merits? There's the other prongs include irreparable injury if relief is not granted, threatened injury outweighs the harm, and then entry of relief would not be adverse to public interest. While Judge Treadwell actually does spend some time on the other ones, the first one, that substantial likelihood of success on the merits, is really important to not just this case, but other, because what it does is he goes into this analysis and says, hey, you're going to win on this. you have a really good likelihood of success on this, because this threat of the First Amendment of forcing people to compel speech and put signs, whether it's in the right of way or in front of their houses, it doesn't matter. And then not giving them a chance to even rebut the signs, basically telling them they're going to be arrested if they cover the sign, if they put up their own sign or anything else, is a serious violation of the First Amendment and the compelled speech. Once he makes that determination, he shifts the burden back to the defendants to show why they couldn't, the plaintiffs couldn't prevail on this. And it's a really good little shifting, which means that now the sheriff is on the defense and has to come up with a reason as to why he should put these signs up. There is nothing in this opinion that states that he could do this. And there's terms like vaguely. They're using a statute that says vaguely must inform the public of the presence of sexual offenders in the community. Then it talks about right of way and whether you even have the right to take that if it's on a private citizen's to put public announcements or signage. And essentially the judge says, no, those are only for traveling utility lines. They do not include a space for the sheriff's public announcements. Then he goes on to talk about the irreparable harm and the First Amendment. And this is really important because when we're talking about any type of these no candy laws that we alluded to earlier or any of the other things, the First Amendment forbids abridgment of the freedom of speech. And the freedom of speech includes both the right to speak freely and the right to refrain from speaking at all. So I think that we can use this argument in a bunch of the other litigation that we're looking into where people's freedom of speech is being infringed upon, whether they're not being allowed to celebrate Halloween at all or put out decorations or Christmas decorations. And the case that they actually cite to, there's a couple of cases, being forced to put something on your license plate, for example, the Live Free and Die state, that was ruled that was compelled speech. Having to put sex offender across your driver's license, that was ruled to be compelled speech. So there's a lot of good things that he cites to, and I think that we can make this really widespread. One of the other things that's really important in here is this Doe 1 v. Marshall. And if anybody's familiar with this case, it's been quoted on several things, several publicity and news things, that essentially it states, the judge in that case states, sex offenders are not second-class citizens. And the judge quotes that in here. They are not second-class citizens. Therefore, you can't just go and do what you want to do to them when you want to do it and expect there to be no reprisal and expect it to be constitutional. So it's a great analysis. I love how he cites the case law in here and everything else in here. I can't say enough about this opinion because it is spot on. One of the last things that I will bring up on this is compelling interest and least restrictive means. Judge Treadwell actually points out that, okay, for all these years, you've been doing whatever you were going to do, and now you started putting up signs. How is what you're trying to do now any going to actually accomplish anything better than what you were doing before? And this sheriff goes on to say, oh, well, you know, it would cost us $10,000 to send deputies out to all these places, and it cost us, we had to spend all these time putting these signs up. And the judge basically shoots that down and says, yeah, but you're not showing me how much it would cost just to sit outside of these three people's houses. And you haven't shown that what you're proposing to do is anything other than incredibly expensive and time consuming. So he waves the BS flag on it and shoots it down on that.
Is that a legal term, BS flag?
It is a BS flag, yes.
I was going to say that the judge on the least restrictive means First Amendment, when you're intruding, it has to be narrowly tailored, the least restrictive means. And what the judge was saying is, Sheriff, you just put your hand on that Bible and you said you hadn't had any problem. So clearly less restrictive means are working because you admitted you haven't had any problem. So therefore, you lose by saying that you need more restrictive means, which the First Amendment requires the least restrictive means. And since the least restrictive means have been working, you lose. Very few judges have the courage to do that. And only an Article 3 judge is protected for life. This is the reason why we chose federal court versus state court in Georgia, because a state court judge would find themselves in a Judge Persky situation, or whatever that judge was, California. In the other state that was California, but the other one who got in trouble for, I think that was Massachusetts or somewhere, where he didn't want to waive the person up to adult court.
Yep. New Jersey.
Yeah. So we went to federal court, where we had the protection of Article 3, because this judge called BS. You've admitted that the least restrictive means have worked, but yet you want to increase the restrictions when you're required constitutionally. If you're going to intrude in First Amendment, it has to be the least restrictive means. So, Sheriff, you lose. But judges generally are afraid to do that. And the reason why they're afraid to do that is not because they don't know right from wrong. It's because of you, the voters, who live in those judicial districts, of what you're going to do to them when you have a Judge Persky moment. That's what they're afraid of, because they actually have kids in college, and they have mortgages, and they have car payments, and they have insurance, and they have all the things going on in their life that you have going on in yours. And that's the reason why they're afraid.
Ashley, if I can back up to some of your points, the defense made it a strong, strong point that they never threatened the plaintiffs would be arrested. But when handing them the signs, yeah, and I mean, I could, like, if a cop comes to my door and says, I need you to sign this or else, okay, you didn't say I would be arrested, but you did say or else. So or else to me means I'm going to get tased and beat to death and then, you know, arrested ultimately. But so they only said, like, hey, you are required to post a sign. And then the sign says, this is county property. Where would one draw the line? How is it reasonable that the plaintiff said that they felt that they would be arrested? They even stated that they were told that, but then Sheriff Long and the deputy sheriff both said that they never threatened the people that they would be arrested.
So I don't think the judge bought that at all, that they weren't threatened to be arrested or that there's any voluntariness. And we did actually see that in the other county lawsuit, where they were saying, oh, these signs were purely voluntary. No, that's disingenuous, to use a Larryism. It's completely not in the facts, because if I came to your house and said, here, I want you to put this sign out for Halloween, would you like to do it? Your answer would be, go pound sand. So there's nothing that can even be construed just rationally that these were anything other than forced and compelled.
And how would you ask someone to put a sign out in front of their house when you leave at 5 a.m? She testified that before, you know, she was out before dark and she came home after dark, and she's just going and putting these signs by the mailboxes. I don't know that she necessarily asked all 57 people if they would mind if the sign was posted.
I don't believe they did. I'm just going to say what it is. I don't believe they did. And even the judge alludes to that when he gets down to talking about there might be an instance, might be, where somebody would be willing to put this sign on it. He's not going to rule on that, but he is insinuating that there is nothing voluntary about this.
Hmm. Could they overcome that? Not on the facts that are already in evidence, but going forward, say that they don't learn their lesson. And law enforcement, I have to break it to you, they always want criminals to learn their lesson. Law enforcement has a horrible time learning their lessons. You can sue them, and you can sue them and sue them, and they never seem to learn a thing. They just dig their heels in deeper. But say that of the 157 remaining counties, Bend Hill County announced that they were going to do the same thing. We sent them a cautionary letter, and we're going to survey the offenders there and find out if they in fact did. But if a sheriff wanted to do this and make it voluntary, how would you actually be able to assure it's voluntary? Because when they come with guns and they have a sign and they say, would you like to put this up? Is there any way that can be voluntarily done?
So my argument would be no, because even if they got him to sign releases, I'm with you. How do you know it's not under duress? You've got 100 officers out there in SWAT gear.
Yes.
Stating here, would you like to put this sign up?
Oh, that was something that they pointed at you. Yeah, but that's what they even brought up. Is like, how were you dressed? Were you just dressed in like your casual officer gear, where it's just like khakis and a polo? She's like, no, I had my tactical gear on. Maybe she was still wearing the polo, but she still had the she had her gun on. She had like her tactical boots on. She was like, I don't know if they have the names for these different categories of dress, but she mentioned that she was not in full sheriff, like, you know, Smokey and the Bear hat kind of thing.
I bet that what she said, because this is a standard officer jargon when they testify, I was wearing my uniform, displaying my badge of office, because it is so ingrained in them to testify to that, to establish jurisdiction that they're an officer, that it wouldn't occur to them that this would not be good in this instance. But I don't actually think it would matter. They could have showed up in a polo shirt and camos, and still, you're asking somebody to put a sign that essentially is stating, the sheriff has determined that I am dangerous. That's what the court points out, that I am dangerous. And who's to question that? So it's every way from Sunday, it's compelled speech.
I have, and I just wanted to bring up that so they did bring up in court that they did make the comparisons to the Alabama driver's license thing. And I think even the judge brought up talking about the license plate thing. Is that Connecticut, mm-hmm. Live Free or Die, Larry?
Vermont, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Gotta get,
it's New Hampshire.
Those little thumbprint size states, they're also very confusing to me. And they did bring, our side brought up a whole bunch of examples of least restrictive means of where they could publish information about who the dangerous people are, as opposed to putting signs out in front of people's yards. Something else that I thought maybe should have been brought up is perhaps the signs being out specifically at the time when the kids are trick-or-treating would be an effective method. But they put them out a day in advance, and just general people driving up and down the highway would then see these signs that have no relationship to the trick-or-treating event. And now they're going to know that these people are quote-unquote dangerous. And that felt like it would go beyond the scope of what they were intending even to begin with.
So my argument would be, even if they did put it out for the 3 hours or 4 hours of Halloween, wouldn't have made a difference, because you're still putting it out there. You're still compelling the speech. In fact, they tried to narrow it down and say, but we're only putting it up from a couple days before, yes, Halloween to a couple days after. They tried to narrow it down. That time frame, I don't think, made a bit of difference to the court. It was the fact that those signs were there and that they had told people, you can't cover them up, you can't put anything out, and you have no way to counteract it. Which, when you get back to the license plate thing, the Live Free or Die, one of the arguments made in that case was that you could put a counteracting bumper sticker. But even then, being compelled to essentially state something that you don't have a belief in is compelled speech, and it violates the First Amendment.
They do that here in Georgia. The default license plate says, In God We Trust, and they ask you when you get your license plate if you would like to have something cover it, and then they just put a sticker of your county over it. I'm personally bothered by this. Maybe you should have the default county, and then if you want to display the In God We Trust, would be the more appropriate method.
That's interesting. That hasn't been challenged.
You're a pagan, Andy.
I'm sorry that may be true. Maybe not a pagan.
Yeah.
Those were my only points.
I happen to agree with you, but the this is, actually, when we talk about building a body of case law, it confuses a lot of our people. What does this do in terms of helping us build the body of case law that we need? Because I guess it would be a better question is, why is having we talk about foundations, why is a body of case law important as we intensify our challenges and as we go after more of these what we believe to be unconstitutional things?
So it's interesting, because one of the things when I was reading through here, and I was uber impressed about the body of case law that he cites too. One of the things is, if you were to do a search on some of this just shows the length that he went to do the research. These cases are not what would come up. If I went out and looked for any cases on not having to display signs in Halloween, it wouldn't be the cases that he cited. You would have to know exactly which argument you were using. For example, like undue prejudice would be the Sun America case, or the Doe v. Marshall and the second class citizens and things like that. So it's really, really important that he actually cites to a bunch of cases that we can use going forward. For example, where talking about the loss of First Amendment freedoms, even for a brief time, is sufficient to constitute irreparable injury necessary to justify the issuance of an injunction. The case that he cites in that, it's a federal case, we'll be able to use.
I've never heard of that case before. Have you?
No, which is what's so great about it. Now we have it here.
And that was the judge that gave it to us. We didn't give it to the judge, did we?
No. The judge went through and cited to a bunch of cases that we did not cite to in any of our stuff. I mean, he cites Pacific Gas and Electric Company cases and the entire ordinance and stuff on the signs on what you can post. He cited all the ordinances and everything else. So he went above and beyond and really supported what his order said. Some judges will just issue an order and say, this is the way it is because I said so. He didn't do that. He reasoned it out and gave us stuff that we can build on to attack some of the other things, because there are Supreme Court cases, federal court cases, circuit court cases. So I love that he gave us all of this.
Well, and he did something even more spectacular. He gave us the, it's hard to imagine that they're going to find a three-judge panel at the 11th Circuit. He covered every base that you could possibly argue for an appeal. And of course, they can't undo the injunction for this year. But the appellate court could say the injunction was unfounded, and that it should not have been granted, and then that would preclude us from getting getting our permanent injunction that goes beyond once this case goes to trial or we settle. But this case, I don't see how you'd have to have a really bizarre panel that would be able to overturn this because of the thoroughness of his work.
Yes, and on top of that, because the presumption is that he made the correct ruling. In order for it to be overturned in the circuit court, the defendants are actually going to have to come up with something showing that there was no basis for his ruling. And like you said, he argued it out and did the research and everything else. So it's going to be very, very difficult to be overturned. And I hope they take that into consideration when they're thinking about filing an appeal.
Well, and of course, I always hope that we can conclude cases without having to go up on appeal. But there's almost the challenge there, because Sheriff Long, what you're going to do if you appeal this, and I hope you're listening, what you're going to do is you're going to make this precedent for Georgia, Alabama, and Florida if you take it up to the 11th. And then you're going to have an 11th Circuit opinion that we can wave all over the United States, even though it's not binding. We're going to say we have this persuasive opinion out of the 11th. So if you want to be the one who gives us strong ammunition, I would encourage you to appeal. Because that's what
absolutely
we're
absolutely right.
Let me all right.
And we've seen
go Ashley.
Go ahead.
Well, I was
no, you go ahead.
I was going to ask. I don't want anybody to get like a strained shoulder from patting themselves on the back. How much work did the two of you put into developing this case? I'm thinking you did the mass body of the work.
Which you?
I'm sorry.
Which you? Larry? There's two of which you? There's two of us here.
Well, I know there's two of you. I'm referring to the two of you. You people. I'm referring to. Yeah.
Okay, both
of us. He's referring to you people.
Well, I did a small amount of the work. I don't think it'd be the great body, but I did do the search for the legal team. I did do the coordinating between the legal team to the extent that the coordination was as effective as it could have been. And then Ashley came on board with us, and Ashley did helped us with brief writing and rewriting. And it was a team effort. I wouldn't say that we did the bulk of the work, but Narsil was definitely involved and deserves credit. Narsil put the money up.
Yeah, and I should have mentioned that up front. I mean, I realize you're the legal team, quote unquote, behind it, but Narsil, you guys led the charge in crafting the funding to get
Narsil. Narsil allowed us to do this. And Narsil put the money up, and thanks to the donor support that Narsil has, we've built here on what seemed like a trivial case at the time. We took criticism, as we always do, for anything that we do. People don't understand it. What we've done is we're building the foundation and the body of case law, and Sheriff Long will probably, despite all the advice he's going to get to the contrary, he'll probably try to do the appeal, and he'll probably give us even a stronger hand to play, which, you know, we appreciate that. But Narsil, without Narsil, we wouldn't have got these attorneys. They did not do this on the hope of getting paid later. We did put money into it up front to inspire them.
When will that portion of the decision come down? I think you told me it's a settlement of sorts. Is that right?
if the case were to go to trial, the verdict would be rendered in our favor. If it's not, if the judge did not somehow reverse himself and say I was wrong on granting the injunction, we're going to win the case at trial, because that's the only way we could lose. The judge would have to say, well, gee, having heard all the evidence, now I got this wrong. And I don't see that. So at the conclusion of the case, which could be either concluded by the settlement and entered into a consent agreement or a consent decree, or by going to trial and have the judge render a verdict in our favor, that's when we're entitled to attorney's fees. We can't file now because the case is still operable. We've won the first stage, which is a huge one, because when you get preliminary relief before you've tried your case, and that standard that Ashley articulated is you have to show that you're likely to prevail on the merits. We've already done that. So unless the sheriff can come up with something, which we know he can't because he invented this to start with, unless he can come up with something, he's going to lose at trial. He would be best advised, and I'm giving some friendly advice, you'd be best advised to settle and cut your county's losses. But you never know what law enforcement's going to do.
That's interesting. And so as it stands, if he then proceed, like we're done on our side unless he decides to proceed. If he doesn't, this is just case closed. We paid the money to get.
No, we're mm-hmm. we're not done. We're not done.
Okay.
We won preliminary relief. This case has to either go to trial or it has to be settled. We had only a hearing on the injunction portion. We're wanting a permanent injunction. What we've got is an emergency injunction for Halloween 2019.
Okay. All right. So
Sheriff Long still has the right to put his case on trial and say, Judge, although you did the injunction and although you told me not to put the signs up, I believe I have the right to put the signs up and I want a trial. He has the right to do that.
Okay. So one way or another, there's going to be some sort of funding awarded?
Well, unless the judge decides that he was wrong and Sheriff Long is correct.
Okay. That's cool, though. So down this path. And then if he decides to then appeal it to, where does it go? Does it go to like one of the circuits?
It goes to the 11th Circuit, which is based in Atlanta. And the 11th Circuit covers just three states. It was carved out of the 5th Circuit back in the 70s. It's the state of Georgia, the state of Alabama, and the state of Florida.
Okay.
And we've already got the driver's license case out of Alabama about the compelled speech,
right?
Which is not going to bode well for him. But like I say, when you're dealing with law enforcement mentality, they know one thing, and that's to push ahead and to try harder and to be more bully. So Sheriff Long has vowed to his constituents that he's going to appeal to the Supreme Court. So he very well may take it to 11th Circuit. If he does, he'll be doing us a favor, because we will expand the reach of the decision beyond just this county. So if Sheriff Long wants to be able to break bread with his colleagues and say, thanks to me, I have now saddled where you can't do what you are doing because my arrogance caused you to have an adverse ruling, he can do that. That's his right, and I applaud everybody has the right to their day in court. He has the right to take us to trial, and he has the right to take us up on appeal. That's his right to do that.
And then, obviously, the next step is to go to SCOTUS, if he chooses.
Well, they get to decide if they will like to hear the case or not, but he could certainly file that petition.
And again, granting this injunctive release, the judge said, you guys are completely screwed. The plaintiffs win this, and I mean, to do the injunction. So going forward, you're kind of sort of a moron.
He didn't say that. He said that you're likely to lose, that the evidence is very compelling against you in terms of the legal standards, and that if this case were to proceed to trial, based on what I see here, your hand is so weak, you're likely to lose. That's what the judge said.
Outstanding. Is there anything
but
else?
He still has a right to go to trial, though. We don't want to take that right away from him. He has an absolute right to go to trial. When you elected him sheriff, Butts County, you have the right to spend your money foolishly if that's what you choose to do.
I understand.
Because all you're going to do is waste a bunch of money, and you're going to drive up the prevailing party's attorney's fees, and you're going to drive up their attorney's fees for your county attorney and whatever outside counsel they have to bring in as this moves up. I can guarantee you those country lawyers there in middle Georgia have probably very little Supreme Court experience, and probably even – well, they probably have no Supreme Court experience. They probably have very little appellate court level in the federal courts, because they generally are used to dealing mostly in state court. So if you want to spend all that money, have at it, because ultimately you're going to pay both sides' attorney's fees because we're going to win.
I don't think I have anything else. Ashley?
No, that pretty much sums it up. This is a great opinion and it's a great win for us.
Outstanding. Larry, we're going to close out with our normal stuff, but before, like if you're one of those people who says, oh, they're going to do the closing stuff, well, I have a little extra bonus at the end. It's a little 2-minute long thing. So, Larry, how do people get in? How do they find the podcast first?
That would be registrymatters.co.
And the phone number, because that's your favorite way to reach to people?
747-227-4477. And if you pause and hit replay, you can hear it again.
And of course, I check the email. And so how do they email us?
That would be registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
We love all of our listeners, all of them. We definitely love our Patreon people. And where do they support the podcast on Patreon?
At patreon.com/registrymatters.
Thank you for joining us, Ashley. It's always a pleasure. I really enjoy having you on.
Thank you guys for letting me be on this 100th episode of the podcast. I am honored to be a part of this, and FYP.
Thank you, Ashley. Larry, and truly, I am as well. I mean, it goes without saying. I genuinely enjoy your insight, and words just don't really describe it. And with that, Larry, say some closing remarks before I play this, and then we'll be out.
So, well, I'm so honored that the people have supported us and we've stuck with it, because I did have a lot of dubiosity about dubiosity. Yes, that is a word. A lot of dubiosity about this crazy thing, notion of a podcast. And although we don't have the thousands of listeners, I think that it potentially are there. We have some very loyal listeners and some very loyal supporters, and thank you, every one of you.
But this is, you said earlier, I played the little clip where you said Merland. So this individual goes by the handle of Sol Nwol. And he put together one that was just terrible at first. And I said, come on, man, you can do better than that. And this is what he came up with.
Dear listeners, today marks the 100th union of our favorite two misfits, Andy and Larry, for it is the 100th episode of the Registry Matters podcast. 100 episodes. That's a lot of episodes. That's well over 5,000 utterances of you people from Larry, and we know there's going to be a lot more of those. Anyways, in honor of this milestone, I'd like to raise a glass of non-alcoholic beverage, since a lot of us are still on probation. I don't want to leave anyone out. And make a toast to these two troublemakers for daring to inform people of their rights. In a world where registrants are not allowed to have rights, showing us the reality and truth. A light at the end of the tunnel for many registrants trying to know just what the hell is going on. So hold up your glasses, but be careful not to spill it on your podcast listening apparatus. And toast. No. Hey, Ryan, I didn't mean that literally. No, put the toaster away. That's not what we're here for. We're here to... What are you doing, Will? I just told Ryan not to make toast. Damn it, can we please just have a proper celebration? Brenda, can you help me out here? I'm getting derailed. Anyways, it's a celebration for the 100th episode of Larry's podcast, featuring Andy, or something like that. I may have gotten some details mixed up. Wait, I grabbed the wine instead of the grape juice. This explains why the railing is going off the goes. Oh, who is it?
It's your probation officer.
Oh, shit.
Turn around, hands behind your back.
No, it's a mistake, I swear. Larry, help me. Larry, what are you doing?
Stop resisting.
God, ow, stop clubbing me. Larry! But seriously, happy 100th to the Registry Matters podcast. Here's to the best of fortune for the next 100 more.
Thank you so very, very much for that.
That takes some skill to put together all those sound effects.
He's a very unique, skilled individual.
I know who that individual is. That's so cool to put all that together.
Yep. Thank you, everybody. Have a great night. Love you all, and talk to you soon.
Me too. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Larry.